Moving on, load up. We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is now 1:03 p.m., Monday, April 26, 2021. Developing a quorum here with us today is Representative McKay, Representative Cronk, Vice Chair Hopkins, Representative Gillum, Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher, myself, Representative Putkadok, Representative Fields, and Shragi should be joining us momentarily. They have not indicated their absence. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary, Robin, and our LIO moderator, Marissa. If I can remind you all to please silence your phones and put them up on a notepad, that'd be appreciated. I'd like to welcome Mr. Clark over in the audience, helping carry House Bill 171, which is on our agenda in first hearing. Also on the agenda, we're picking back up the discussion of House Bill 135, which is the geothermal that we heard last week. We weren't able to conclude the presentation from the administration in regards to 135, so we're going to pick that back up today. I believe we were on the Department of Revenue portion of the slide or something like that. Somewhere mid-20s, 24, 23 slide page. I believe Haley Payne, I can't remember who was in the middle of presenting, but if you could please put your name on the record. Grace is here to work the slides for us.
Oh, good afternoon. This is Haley Payne, Deputy Director of Division of Oil and Gas. Pardon me, I think I have a little feedback here. There we go. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine, and there's no feedback now. Haley, can you hear us?
Well, hopefully you can still hear me clearly.
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Can I get a confirmation if you are able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us? We'll take a brief of these. Back on the record, I'd like to welcome Representative Shragi and Representative Fields joining us at 105. Ms. Payne, can you hear us now?
Yes, I can hear you. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we were able to hear you before, but you weren't able to hear us, but now you are, so I think we're good to go.
Great. Thank you so much. I do appreciate that. So just to state again for the record, my name is Haley Payne. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. We do appreciate your time this afternoon to continue our presentation on the geothermal bill. Last week, we were able to give a brief introduction on geothermal systems in Alaska and how they operate. We also introduced the bill itself and a summary of what it'll be doing. We'd like to take the committee actually to slide 26. On this slide, we are going to go into a couple of examples of where we may see this bill be able to be applied, and that will be what Director Masterman will provide. And then following this, Sean Clifton, our policy and program specialist at the division, will provide a little bit further information to a couple of questions that came up last week from Representatives Hannon and Hopkins. So with that, I will turn that over to Director Masterman. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Masterman, can you give us a radio check, please?
Yes, good afternoon. I can hear you loud and clear. This is Steve Masterman, Director of the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Fine. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, then let's talk about some rocks some more. So if we could go on to the next slide, which is slide 27 for Mount Spur. What I would like to do is just give you a little background on two systems, geothermal systems in the state, Mount Spur and Pilgrim Hot Springs and tie the work that has been and is being done there to some of the changes that are being proposed in the legislation. So here the first slide is, our first example is Mount Spur, which, as you know, is just across Cook Inlet from Anchorage. In this slide here, there are two maps. The map on the left shows kind of the regional location of Mount Spur and the hot springs. Mount Spur is a volcano, so this is a volcano-related system. And it's located about 20 miles from the, let's see, it's more like 35 miles, I guess, from the power lines that run from the Beluga power plant on the west side of Cook Inlet to feed Anchorage and tie into the rail belt. So its proximity to the, you know, the power grid is very attractive. Mount Spur is not officially a hot spring. It is a warm spring. It has a surface temperature of about 40 degrees centigrade. And so people who are exploring it are obviously going to be looking to find the source of some hotter water, which will contain more energy. So on the right here, this figure on the right is kind of a zoomed-in look at Mount Spur. And the red dots in the upper left-hand corner are where the hot springs are actually located on the southern flank of the volcano. And you can see that there, the area that the two companies who are applying to work in this area, GeoAlaska and Razor Geothermal, have two areas that they're interested in exploring for geothermal energy. The blue dots on just to the right of those two blocks are the boreholes that were drilled by Ormat in the early 2000s, I believe it was. And the deepest of those holes goes to a depth of about 4,000 feet. On this figure, again, you can see Cook Inlet to the southeast in the lower right-hand corner. And this is a snapshot of the statewide geology map. And the green colors are sedimentary rocks that are quite thick and fill the Cook Inlet basin. These are the tertiary conglomerates that are present along this part of Cook Inlet. And the combined sedimentary package in Cook Inlet is somewhere around 30,000 feet thick. So these sediments can be extremely thick. The pink rocks here are volcanic rocks and igneous rocks. And obviously coming out of Mount Spur are lavas and volcanic flows. And those are the pink rocks that the Ormat drilled into. Ormat drilled through the volcanic rocks hoping to hit hot water, but instead they drilled into the underlying sediments. A thick sequence of Westmoreland conglomerates. And as I mentioned, they did not get out of those. Even down to a depth of 4,000 feet, the rocks were dry and cold. And so basically Ormat had the equivalent of a dry hole. They did not encounter any warm rock that's above background geothermal gradient. And so they relinquished their exploration permit and walked away. So what these two companies who are coming in here have to do is to take the available information and try to understand the geology sufficiently so that they can focus or find areas where those hot waters will be coming up. So what they will be doing is they will be looking for fracture systems or permeable beds in the volcanic stratigraphy that will be transmitting those hot waters to the surface so they can follow that back toward the source, which in this case is presumably located near the volcano. So you can see there are fairly sizable areas under consideration. The wells that were drilled by Ormat are about 5 or 6 miles away from the surface expression of the hot springs. That gives you some extent, idea of the area within which geothermal exploration will occur surrounding the hot springs. And also, these holes were drilled by Ormat in, the early 2000s, so at least a decade ago. And now we have people coming back in who are interested, and these companies will do some geologic mapping. They'll probably do some geophysical exploration before they do any drilling. And if they're successful with their first round of drilling, that's great. If they're not, they'll have to go back and do more surface work, more geophysics probably, and more exploration. And as we know, that is a very seasonal activity here, so it requires multiple years to do the kind of work, the investigative work that's necessary to locate the springs, or the reservoir of hot water that could then be produced. So again, they have to understand the geology, they need a big area, and they need the time required to find the source of the hot water. So if we could go to the next slide, which is the second example. This is from Pilgrim Hot Springs on the Seward Peninsula. And Pilgrim Hot Springs has hot water on the surface at a temperature of about 50 degrees centigrade. Drilling has intersected hot water in this geothermal system at around a temperature of 90 degrees centigrade at about 120 meters or 400 feet roughly. But the reservoir has a theoretical temperature of about 150 degrees centigrade, and so people are trying to find that source of hotter water. And on the left-hand side of this slide is the regional geology map again, and you can see where Pilgrim Hot Springs is in the middle, and Nome is situated about 40 miles to the southwest, and immediately west of Pilgrim Hot Springs is the Graphite Creek deposit, which is the nation's largest deposit of graphite and is potentially a mine at some point in the near future. Nome has a power requirement of about 6 megawatts, and the Graphite Creek mine, should it go into production, would require about the same amount of energy, so about 6 megawatts of power for Graphite Creek. Right now, Nome and the Graphite Creek mine, should it go into production, would be using diesel generation, expensive form of power. And Pilgrim Hot Springs, right now, the water that has been found has a potential to produce about 5 megawatts, and if they can find the reservoir, the potential would be in the tens of megawatts for electrical generation. So potential to power Nome and the Graphite Creek mine. Now on both of these figures, there's some heavier black lines running east to west, and those are faults. And those faults have dropped down the area to the north of those faults in the Imaruk Basin. And so you have a deep basin filled with recent sediments that are fault bounded, much like the Basin Range in Nevada. And it's very common for the hot waters to be coming up around those faults. And in the case of Pilgrim Hot Springs, the drilling that has been done suggests that the hot water is not coming up from immediately beneath the surface springs. In fact, you drill beneath the surface springs, you get hot water near the surface, and then it gets cooler. And so the temperature drops, and the idea is that those hot waters are coming up along one of those faults and then moving through the unconsolidated sands and gravels to the point that they make their way to the surface. And on the right-hand figure here it's got the geology, it has the land status, it has the location of the hot springs. It has a little box right around the hot springs that shows where the drilling has occurred, so it's very close to the hot springs. And yet, the hot water, the reservoir, could be along one of those faults that is 3 to 5 to 6 miles away to the south. So here we see a situation where exploration began in the 1980s. 1984 was the first drilling, and has yet to find the source of the hot water. And it's a situation where the hot water may be coming up out of the bedrock a number of miles away, and it's going to take the company that explores this quite a bit of time, quite a few field seasons, and quite a lot of area to try to unravel how that hot water is making its way to the current springs and where it's coming from. So I think both of these examples show the need to understand the geology. They show the need for a large area to explore, and they show the need for a prolonged period of time to do that exploration work, and those are some of the things that are being addressed in this piece of legislation. So Happy to take any questions, or if there are none, I would turn it over to Mr. Clifton with the Division of Oil and Gas to address some of the committee's prior questions.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Any questions, concerns, comments from any committee members? I know Friday we ushered the presentation along so we can gavel out at a reasonable time. So if you have any questions on any of that previous presentation, feel free. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure who should answer it, but back on slide 24, I just want to put on the record, because we had a question and then talked about it after we adjourned, but the word artificially, naturally or artificially present in the geothermal system. Could someone make sure we understand what those artificial fluids are, geothermal liquids that are artificial?
Through the chair, this is Steve Masterman, Director of Division of Oil and Gas. So some of the new technologies that are coming along, some of the new developments in geothermal energy, for example, fracking, the use of fracking in the development of oil and gas wells is pretty well established now. And there are developments taking place that could allow for the development of dry geothermal systems, so where you have an area of just hot rock. So if you frack the hot rock, you could introduce fluids into the hot rock and then recover those fluids in a separate borehole. And those would be artificially introduced fluids that were placed into the hot rock and then recovered from a separate borehole. Another example may be if you have a dry, hot area, then you can introduce a coolant in a fluid in a closed loop system, sort of like the thermopiles on the Trans-Alaska pipeline, where you would, pump the liquid down through the borehole, through a tube in the borehole, and then it would evaporate and come back up to the surface and carrying energy. That energy would be recovered. The fluid would then be condensed and would go back down the pipe in a cold closed loop system. So that again would be an artificially introduced liquid. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. It does.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman, and thank you, Representative Hannon. And before we move on to follow up on Friday's questions, are there any other questions or comments from committee members? Seeing or hearing none, I believe Mr. Clifton was going to provide some follow-up from last Friday's meeting.
Yes, good afternoon. For the record, this is Clifton from the Division of Oil and Gas and Policy and Program Specialist. And the two questions that I noted from the last presentation, one was from Representative Hopkins with reference to slide 21 in the presentation. And if I may restate the question as I understood it, it was, is this the only instance where the state would grant an exemption for private use of the state's mineral estate? And the answer is yes, this is the only instance where a subsurface mineral resource that the state has would be making an exception for private use. In contrast, if a private person who does not own the mineral estate underneath their private property finds gold on their property or drills a natural gas well for personal use, they would still be required to go through the standard processes for obtaining a claim or a lease, comply with all the permitting requirements, and pay royalties on what they produce. Before I proceed, does Representative Hopkins or anybody else have any follow-up questions to that?
No, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Clifton. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. We do have Representative Fields with a question.
Question more on the industry than the bill. What are some recent geothermal generating projects, maybe down the lower 48, and what kind of prices per kilowatt hour are they seeing?
I don't have an answer off the top of my head for that. Sorry.
No problem.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Any other questions or comments in regards to House Bill 135 in general? Seeing or hearing none, we do have Mr. Jeremy Price on the line. I know he wasn't signed in on the last meeting, but in regards to House Bill 135 and geothermal in context to oil and gas, if you'd like to provide some maybe information that maybe we hadn't heard yet or anything like that, you're more than welcome to.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Jeremy Price with Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I'm available for questions if you have any for AOGCC, but I can simply say that DNR worked with the commission to identify any issues or concerns that we may have had, and we fully support this legislation. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Price. Before we move on to the next item on the agenda, last call for questions or comments on 135. Mr. Clifton.
If I may, Representative, or Chairman.
Yep, Mr. Clifton.
I did have one more question to answer for Representative Hannon.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I cut you off. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No worries. So Representative Hannon, with reference to slide 22 in the presentation, asked a couple of questions about how a developer's right to access the subsurface intersects with the private surface owner's rights. And basically, it's a well-established in state law, as noted on the slide, statute 3805.125, as well as federal law and laws in almost every other jurisdiction where the subsurface estate has primacy. And what that means is a subsurface owner or lessee must be given reasonable use of the surface for purposes of exploration and production. And reasonable is the operative term here. So if a developer wants access to private surface property, they will approach the owner and come to a private agreement with some form of compensation and, other financial assurances. Sometimes it's just money. Sometimes it's in the form of infrastructure, like improving a road or building a road where there wasn't one before. And, that can be really valuable for the private property owner. With geothermal development, I could easily see free energy being a part of that bargain. And so if the surface owner is too disagreeable, then the developer is going to seek another location. But if no alternative location is possible, then the parties are unable to come to a private agreement, then they may ask DNR to intervene under Alaska Statute 3805.130, and then the procedure is defined in 11 AAC 86145, which is also on that slide. And so, commercial developers of all sorts, from natural gas companies to cell phone companies, engage in these sorts of private, mutually beneficial agreements every day, and they virtually never rise to the level of government intervention to settle a dispute. One classic Alaskan example would be the natural gas pipeline that Conoco built to the village of New Ixit, through which they provide free natural gas to the village. And although it's not a subsurface-related issue, it's still a similar type of issue affecting the surface owner, where cell phone companies build their towers on private property all the time. And they usually compensate with a monthly rental payment to the property owner, plus, like free internet and cell phones every year and stuff like that. And so, this is not an unusual scenario, and it's almost always settled privately. So, do you have any follow-up questions, Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Mr. Clifton, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the two examples of potential projects in Alaska that were given, one was about Mount Spur tying into the Beluga power lines. Looks like what the goal would be there, that's an established surface infrastructure. And then the Pilgrim Hot Springs is sort of, again, it's logical to look at that's they're looking close to a hot spring for a mine not too far away. Help me visualize what the surface infrastructure looks like once you strike hot water and you go, we've got enough of a pool and a temperature that we want to generate this, and whether it's we want to generate it and send it a mile away to a new mine or whether we need to get this power into an already existing power grid. What's that surface infrastructure look like that the two examples we have are sort of isolated and we can know where they are, but if we're changing a statute and we know that there's geothermal pockets all over Alaska, what's it look like when they strike hot water and now we need to tie this into a system or create a power system from it? What's the surface infrastructure look like?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, my guess is that for something at Mount Spur is they would build the geothermal plant, you know, as close as they could to where the hottest water source is, and then they would stretch power lines from there to wherever the grid ends. I don't know if the grid stretches to Tyonek or if it starts at the Beluga power plant, but they would probably be looking for an easement to run power lines. And so that would be a combination of, I believe, you know, RCA, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, as well as, you know, securing an easement for power lines through DNR.
Follow-up, Representative
Hannon? Well,
I would like to give Steve Masterman or Haley Payne an opportunity to jump in here if they have anything to add on that.
Mr. Masterman, Ms. Payne, at your discretion.
Yeah, for the record, Steve Masterman here, Director of DGGS, and Representative Hannon. Just to add a little bit more to your question there, I think Mr. Clifton's right. You know, it would be a small facility near the hot springs at the well field where the energy is coming out of the ground. And usually, you know, there's a small well field, and then there would be some reinjection wells, so the water that's coming out gets put back in again, and that's a little conservation of energy involved there. And then there would be a building where the power turbines would be located, and there may be a road to access that if it was economical to have a road, or maybe an airstrip, and then, as Mr. Clifton said, a power line to tie into the grid. They're not super intrusive facilities, I would say. You know, there may be some cooling towers with a little bit of steam coming out of them, but they're pretty self-contained, really, once they're established, because there's no product going in. The only product coming out is electrons, and those travel along the power line.
Thank you, Mr. Masterman. Representative Hannon.
One follow-up. Could you give, when you say small, can you give me either in feet or meters what we mean by small? I mean, is this a 20-foot tall pump, or is it a 2-foot pump?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I suppose it sort of depends on how big the geothermal system is. Some of these systems on Iceland that are producing, you know, hundreds of megawatts, they would be a fairly large power plant. But then for something like Chena Hot Springs, which is producing hundreds of kilowatts, they're, you know, a small warehouse kind of a size. So, it sort of depends on how big the geothermal field is that is encountered. But once you get up to industrial scale, you're at industrial scale.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess on that, in the case in point that was provided in the slide in regards to Nome and the graphite mine, power needs being at, I think it was 12 megawatts and potential for a 10 megawatt geothermal facility there. What would that look like as far as physical size? I'm not sure if that's Mr. Masterman or Mr. Clifton.
Yeah, I think we're, through the chair, this is Steve Masterman, Director of DGS. I think maybe we should provide some examples of some visuals for the committee so you can see what power plants around the world look like at different sizes. And rather than us speculating over the call, that's acceptable.
That makes sense to me. Thank you, Mr. Masterman. We look forward to that follow-up. We're talking a Walmart or we're talking a gas station, right?
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments that somebody's just itching to get answered, feel free. I guess on Mr. Clifton, you started to mention in page slide 22 in regards to private surface owners that maybe between the organization that's pursuing a resource and the private surface owner, if there's not a mutual understanding in those statutes that you mentioned. Does that go as far as potential for eminent domain or anything like that?
No. So eminent domain, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not an expert on how eminent domain works. That's more of a Department of Transportation type of scenario.
Okay.
I don't think that's what would be applied here at all.
Just throwing the question out. I think when you phrased it, you said that when they can't get into a mutual agreement, then that's where the state intervenes. So I just wanted to gauge it to what level they intervene.
I see. So I guess it would be more of a situation of the commissioner, you know, adjudicating a reasonable agreement, you know, terms of an agreement, like you know, the operator will use only this area and make, you know, post a bond of this value in case they, you know, make a mess, or you know, knock a tree down on somebody's house or something like that. You know, posting a bond is a normal part of these sorts of agreements, and then and then say, you know, you will only use the land for this amount of time, and you know, you'll have an opportunity to amend the agreement at this time. And basically, you know, if the landowner is not willing to, you know, engage in a good faith negotiation of an agreement, then you know, the landowner and the developer can then go to the commissioner and work that out in an open forum, each making their case before the commissioner. You know, and again, it's very rarely done. I can only think of one time in my memory that it's been done at all in DNR.
Okay, thank you for that, Mr. Clifton. I believe that sparked a couple of other questions. We've got Representative Gillum, then Representative Hannon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure which one this would be for, but just out of curiosity, say the Pilgrim Mine up towards Nome, you find what you're looking for. What kind of a timeline are you looking at as far as being able to come online with the power plant?
Steve Masterman, can you handle that one?
Through the chair, Representative Gillum, great question. If once you found the geothermal reservoir, there's a period of time for engineering studies to be done for them to figure out how, you know, what size power plant, how to engineer and design the facilities, and obviously the power lines, and then you have all the permitting that needs to go on, and then presumably the economics have to be, you know, established and confirmed, and so that is probably, you're looking at 5 to 10 years, I would think, somewhere in that time frame, sort of the same issues are involved with permitting, you know, a power plant being put into place as you might have for another facility in sort of a remote part of the state. So it's not instantaneous, but I think that, you know, 5 to 10 years is probably a reasonable time frame to be looking at once you have discovered the resource.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you. And I guess just to be clear, this is an state-owned or operated power production facility. I mean, that'd either be a co-op or a private enterprise of some sort. We're just establishing the process in which they, you know, go after permits to pursue these types of endeavors. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if it's for Mr. Clifton or Mr. Masterman, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. So under current law, where we've given a geothermal permit out to pursue energy, what are their subsurface rights currently, as opposed to what the bill is doing and treating them just like oil and gas?
Haley Payne, could you take that one?
Absolutely. Representative Hannon, through the chair, this is Haley Payne again. So currently, the way this works is that if someone were to come in for a geothermal prospecting permit application, Within 30 days, the surface right owner needs to express whether or not they want to lay an application or a claim on top of that, essentially. And so then the surface use owner has 30 days to basically kind of say, oh, if this permit's going in, I want to put my own application in. And then their application is treated with preference over the second one. So it is still limited to a 30-day window in which to act. So that is the only difference that's really taking place here, is we're not allowing the surface owner to say if somebody else submits an application that they want to submit one on top of it.
If you don't got a follow-up, I do.
Go ahead with
yours. So I guess what would be the reason to, if I was a private landowner, to put in an application once a player in the industry does?
The chair there. So I believe the reason would be to hope to then say that you have the rights to the resource and then basically sell it back to the person that was going to go develop it and try to take for yourself some sort of share of royalty or share of rental. So essentially to kind of, unless they happen to be, you know, capable of developing a geothermal resource themselves, but they may be interested in, essentially asserting themselves into it and then selling the rights to the land in addition to the state. And so again, you know, as we brought up in the previous presentation, is that if that landowner is going to be using that, wants to have a, you know, a personal use type of geothermal development, like a home heat pump or something, this would not in any way allow that to be taken away from them. This is simply to basically maybe alleviate a system where there'd be some sort of kind of double rentals or something placed on a geothermal developer who's just looking to explore for energy.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hanna, did you have a follow-up?
Not right now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Ms. Payne, is there any other questions or comments from committee members before we move on? Seeing or hearing none, the plan is to pick this bill back up on Friday. I guess if there's more devil in the detail questions that anyone might have, feel free to reach out to my office and we can help convey that to the department or to the department directly that we can bring back up on the record on Friday. With that, we'll move on to House Bill 171, PFAS, Use and Remediation, Fire, Water, and Safety, sponsored by our very own Representative Hannon. I believe Mr. Tim Clark is here to help with some of the introduction and question answering. Representative Hannon and Mr. Clark, if you guys could please put yourself on the record and begin the introduction to House Bill 171.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Representative Sarah Hannon. I represent House District 33 here in northern southeast Alaska. And I have with me my Chief of Staff, Tim Clark. House Bill 171 is about PFAS. Now, I'm going to use the acronym, and it does not cover all of the types of PFAS and PFOA compounds they are. And it is a shorthand acronym for perfluoroalkali and polyfluoroalkali substances. They are collectively used or commonly referred to as PFAS. And the PFAS that we are specifically in this bill addressing are the aqueous film-forming foams that are used by airports and oil and gas firefighting response. They're extremely effective at starving oxygen out of fires and therefore are the preferred firefighting foam for high-temperature fires. There is a downside to that. PFAS has been linked very closely to severe health conditions, including low birth weight, thyroid diseases, and a variety of organ-related cancers. And here's the real bad news. PFAS contamination exists all over Alaska in the water tables and has recently been tested and found in North Pole, Fairbanks, Gustavus, Dillingham, and I hear in Sand Lake neighborhood of Anchorage. Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation has declared PFAS a hazardous substance, but when it comes to setting the limit of what makes PFAS in your drinking water an allowable limit, the department has continued to defer to levels set by the Environmental Protection Agency that most people working in and around PFAS concerns say the EPA standards are far too high. They allow too much in. House Bill 171 sets a health-protected PFAS level that is set by a working group of experts assembled by Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, and we put that standard into statute. The bill ensures that for communities that have water that's been contaminated, the Department of Environmental Conservation will provide alternative drinking water sources. House Bill 171 attempts to address and clarify the matter of polluter pays liability. An entity that is responsible for fire that results in the use of PFAS foam is liable for the costs of the drinking water pollution, the test of the drinking water, and voluntary blood testing by those who have been drinking or exposed to that water. A person who has used PFAS foam to extinguish a fire, i.e. a volunteer fire department, are not liable. House Bill 171 would stop more PFAS from being introduced into the Alaska environment by prohibiting their use as soon as the foams are no longer required by federal law, which is October 4th, 2021, this October. The bill does exempt oil and gas industry from the prohibition on PFAS firefighting foam until the state fire marshal determines there is a safe and effective alternative for oil and gas industry use. The bill also requires DEC to accept up to 25 gallons of PFAS from persons across the state for disposal. This is so that in a community where you've got a PFAS-containing fire truck, your community is not now stuck with the cost of figuring out how to dispose of the PFAS that you thought you had and that you can't dispose of in your community. So every community could return up to 25 gallons back to the state for disposal. Additionally, related to PFAS disposal, the legislation prohibits thermal remediation, i.e. burning, of PFAS contamination unless a facility to do that obtains a permit from the Department of Environmental Conservation and ensures that the process is not just resulting in the release of an airborne compound with a carbon-fluorine bond. As you come to learn about PFAS, you will frequently hear it referred to as the forever chemicals. They are long chains of hydrogen compounds, 14, 16, 18 carbons in it. And the thing about PFAS is that it's a permanent. It does not degrade over time. It does not disperse through a water system, but it does migrate. And one of the things that I've learned about PFAS in the last 3 years is we all have had some PFAS exposure. It is a ubiquitous substance that's been used since the 1940s. So Gore-Tex waterproof clothing is manufactured out of a PFAS combination. That's why it makes it so good at stopping that rain barrier. Teflon, anti-stick things on pans. My favorite dental floss, Glide, what makes it slippery so it slides through your teeth. Those are all things that PFAS compounds are used in. And so we've all been exposed. But what we now know is when it's in our drinking water and we are consuming it and showering in it, the exposure reaches toxic levels pretty quickly. For decades, the FAA required annually that airports test their firefighting capability by dispersing the foam annually on fire tarmacs. Most of Alaska, that is the primary mechanism of it getting into the water systems and water table and creating toxic wells. PFAS has no smell. It has no oily residue.
It doesn't discolor anything. So it is only when the State Department of Transportation actively began testing water systems near airports where they knew that they had tested PFAS-related foam as required by FAA to prove that you could put out a fire, that they started to realize how broadly polluted Alaska's water table is. And with that, I can either take questions or we can have Mr. Clark go into a sectional or...
Thank you, Representative Hannon. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this for us. And like you said, Fairbanks certainly has a big problem with this, whether it's out in the Moose Creek area or in the Fairbanks youth soccer facility where they had to stop watering the grass with affordable water. This does not prevent the use of PFAS foams at airports. It stops the testing of it. It keeps it it's still there to actually put a fire out, but they're not required to test it anymore. Is that correct? Or am I back?
The DOT in Alaska has told our airports to not test. The FAA final change of that rule is October. But for about a year, we have not been using the annual testing. And,
if I may, for the record, this is Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Hopkins, the bill does, in fact, ban the use of these firefighting foams at Alaska airports that were formerly required to use them, but only after the FAA rescinds its requirement, which is scheduled for October 1st, 2021.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. Thank you, Mr. Clark. I think with that, it might be wiser for us to go through a sectional analysis before we open up for general questions, if you will, Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. Section 1 of the bill creates several new sections in AS 46.03. In 46.03340A, it directs the Department of Environmental Conservation to ensure that responsible parties test drinking water near PFAS spills, and also requires the department to make sure anyone with contaminated drinking water gets clean water for drinking purposes and at least one voluntary test of their blood if they want to sort of have an assessment of what their level of exposure is. The new section 4603340B is kind of one of the more important sections of the bill in that this is where the health-based maximum levels of contamination in drinking water for 7 PFAS chemicals are listed and delineated. And not only does it set these new, more strict levels according to what was learned by the panel of experts in Michigan, but it maintains Alaska DEC's authority to set more protective thresholds if in the future, as these chemicals are studied more, it's determined prudent to do so. 4603340C requires DEC to make sure a responder exposed to PFAS contamination gets also at least one blood test if they so desire, also you know, to kind of determine their level of exposure, a sort of baseline for an individual, you might say. Section 4603345A states it's having to do with liabilities, it's stating that a person that is most likely, you know, a company or a commercial entity that causes a fire that results in the release of PFAS contaminating foams is liable for the cost of providing what's referenced above, the clean drinking water testing, and the voluntary blood testing. 4603345B states that persons who use PFAS containing substances to extinguish a fire, meaning fire departments, for the most part, are not held liable for those costs, you know, the those provisions so far mentioned in the bill, basically because, you know, they're simply doing their job in important circumstances. And 4603345C states that the liability for these costs is in addition to other liability existing in areas of state law relevant to the release of these substances. 345D provides a definition for motor vehicle and residential buildings as they're used in that section, because there is an exemption for if these firefighting foams are used in a residence or in, say, a car fire, something of that nature. It's kind of a way to make sure that these liabilities are not focused on individual Alaskans who may suffer these mishaps, as happens in people's lives, but it's more focused on commercial entities. So 345A is the exemption for the oil and gas industry generally, both in production, transmission, and transportation. This basically is, you know, the exemption is here in part justified by the ubiquitousness, you know, of oil and gas facilities around the state. It is one of the backbones of our economy. We have facilities such as the entire Trans-Alaska Pipeline, the loading facilities in Valdez, that sort of thing, refineries here and there. And it's very well acknowledged that the intensity of those fires can be something else. So, but it's also important to note in the next section, 350B, that if the time comes that the state fire marshal determines that a safe and effective alternative for the oil and gas industry exists, that the fire marshal can publish that finding in a public notice, and the alternative effective substances need to subsequently be used by the oil and gas industry as well. So, 350C has to do with DEC's required, it's the department will be required to take up to 25 gallons per year of PFAS containing firefighting foam from Alaskans for disposal. That's because it does in fact exist, you know, in the storehouses of airports and firefighting companies across the state, and it's a way to at least help diminish the existence of these chemicals in the state. That also relates, you know, to sections lower, you know, further down in the bill when they talk about thermal remediation. Right now there's a great deal of research coast to coast going into finding the safest ways to dispose of, you know, the existing chemicals that exist that are, you know, across the country. Thermal remediation is showing some promise, but the bill wants to make absolutely sure that if that method is used, it has to be determined to be a safe method, and that determination will be reflected in required permit. I believe I'm at 350D, Essentially, this harkens back to the out-and-out ban on the use of these chemicals at our airports in the state. And the, as I was mentioning to Representative Hopkins, the effective date of that ban would be October 4th of 2021, when the FAA is no longer requiring that those chemicals, you know, chemicals be employed. The new section 355 goes into to the thermal remediation and the sort of sidebars put on that that I just referenced in terms of the permitting and the to ensure that use of thermal remediation is not going to simply result in the spread of you know, related compounds, you know, through the air to the nearby environs. And let's see. Oh, and 4603359 is the list of the seven compounds covered in the bill, with the main maintenance that the department has the authority to list more if more of these compounds, you know, are deserving of this kind of attention. Remaining sections of the bill go into some areas of uncodified law, where section 2 addresses the retroactivity, making the bill regarding, well, particularly the liability sections, applicable pretty broadly to you know, discharges, certain discharges of these chemicals that may have taken place before the bill's effective date, on or after. This is section 3 adds transition language regarding the adoption of regulations for implementing the act and the effective date of those regulations. I think it's just so that the department can, you know, get a head start on writing those regulations, but obviously they would not be they would not be in effect until the effective date of the bill. Section 4 once again goes back to the October 4th, 2021 effective date of the prohibition on the use of PFAS in section 1 of the bill. Section 5 gives an immediate effective date to sections 2 and 3 of the Act. And finally, section 6 provides an effective date of January of next year, 2022, except for those sections of the bill where the you know, that become effective on different dates. So there's a little bit of untangling in all those separate effective date provisions, depending on which section of the bill you're looking at. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be willing to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. If anybody's got any questions or comments, if you can, if it's about specific language, if you could please give us a page number and a line, that'd be helpful, or a section. Representative Fields.
Thank you. I, through the chair, I definitely appreciate Representative Hannon for bringing this bill forward. So thank you for doing the legwork on such a pressing issue. And, you know, I've followed in the media issues around PFAS, and, you know, one of the things I've wondered is just about the science and tracking PFAS and PFAS-like substances. And I was wondering if you could speak a little more to your the cutoff concentrations on page 2. And I know you referenced kind of a working group based in Michigan. I just don't have all the background on how long has the science been going on, what's the current state of the science, what should we expect to see in terms of, you know, scientists identifying additional PFAS or PFAS-like substances that the department might want to regulate, kind of how, what is the pace of that scientific change? Thank you.
Do you want to take it? And I was going to say, we do have one invited speaker today who is a constituent who is how I first learned about PFAS and PFOA, because one of my communities is on the front edge of the PFAS problem in Alaska. And so they've schooled me up. But you were specifically asking about the Michigan rankings, and so I'll have Mr. Clark address that, and then Ms. McLaughlin online can talk to you about the emerging science.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fields, an example, we could only speak generally in terms of how more of these compounds are being recognized to have serious potential harmful effects. This seems to be, it's been unfolding over the last decade or so, with more and more attention, attention building toward these issues on an annual basis. One way to maybe illustrate the way scientists' understanding of the potential harms, that can result from exposures to these chemicals, how that understanding is growing, would be to turn to, in your bill packets, there's a list of PFAS substances that are covered in the bill. And it also lists the cutoff concentrations in parts per millions that the bill adapts from the Michigan research. And if you compare the cutoff concentrations in the bill to what is currently under EPA recommendation, it's a little bit telling, because you can, starting with, and I can't for the life of me pronounce the full names of these, so I'll stick with the short name. So at the top of the list, PFBS, the concentration cutoff that we're using based on expert recommendation is 420 parts per trillion. The EPA has no listing whatsoever for a cutoff concentration in that particular PFAS. PFOA, which I believe is one of the most widespread, the cutoff that the bill recommends or includes is 8 parts per trillion. What EPA is listing is 70 parts per trillion, many times that. For PFOS, the cutoff concentration in the bill is 16 parts per trillion. What EPA recommends is 70, once again, many times that level. PFNA, the bill suggests or includes 6 parts per trillion as a cutoff concentration. The EPA lists none, no guidance for that. And the same for PFHXS, PFHPA, and Gen X. The EPA has no recommendations for cutoff concentrations for those. However, the bill includes, respectively, 51 parts per trillion, 400,000 parts per trillion, and 370 parts per trillion.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Follow-up, Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, in terms of EPA regulations, are these regulations under the Toxic Substances Control Act or a different federal statute, to the extent that you happen to know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fields, I can't answer that question. I could find that out for you and bring it to you later.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
I'm guessing they're regulated under the Toxic Substances Control Act, which is kind of interesting because I think it's widely regarded as the greatest failure in terms of, the decade of landmark federal environmental laws. TSCA just doesn't work. So, again, a reminder on how important this bill is. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Field. Mr. Clark?
And, Mr. Chairman, may I add to that, Representative Fields, that the EPA has got a project underway looking at these substances and issues. But currently, they're not really regulated as so much as there are recommendations in EPA for what tolerable levels should be. And that's one of the reasons so many states have taken it upon themselves to set their own tolerable limits.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Before we go on to invited testimony with Ms. McLaughlin, like Representative Hannon mentioned, Are there any other questions or comments? I believe Representative Rauscher, then Representative McKay.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yep.
Through, Representative Rauscher. Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, is this a model that was homegrown, or was it modeled after something in Lower 48?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rauscher, this is modeled very closely to the findings of what's known as the let's see, well,
was it a study out of Michigan?
I think Michigan's PFAS Action Response Team Working Group, and they were, I believe, assembled in about 2018, spent some considerable amount of time, perhaps a year or more, with a pretty impressive roster of members, and released their findings in 2019, and subsequently those were adopted by the state of Michigan, in their regulation of these chemicals.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Follow up, Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. And so have you worked with the military or the oil field or any of the other agencies when you built this one?
Representative Hannon.
So a couple of those pieces I can address. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Federal law does not, state law does not allow us to regulate the feds. So in Alaska, the military bases, which is actually where our first PFAS pollution notifications came out of, our state law won't regulate them. It was more that gave us an awareness. States like Michigan, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Minnesota have been working on PFAS pollution in their environment, starting with manufacturers and industry. In Alaska, ours seems to be isolated either to military installations, oil and gas refining where it's been used, or our airports. So we're kind of a little late to the game of the PFAS crisis because we don't have industrial manufacturing aside from oil and gas, but we're not manufacturing any PFAS substances. So in New Hampshire, you were manufacturing some equipment and PFAS was a primary component, and your industrial effluent was polluting the water system. In Alaska, we have more of sort of isolated by airport exposures or military installations or the refinery in North Pole. Those are the locations. So there are some pieces in this. My senator, Senator Keel, and I, who got elected together at the same time in 2018, and it was new that DOT across Alaska was testing airports, and the community of Gustavus that we were going to represent was one of the places where they had just that spring said, your water's toxic, we're providing you bottled water, it's from the airport runoff. So there are a few pieces in the bill that were kind of homegrown, like the state taking back the PFAS contamination, because in most parts of America, you've got some level of government between your local volunteer fire department and the state, but in much of Alaska, we don't. So that's a component that we thought was really important, and not a lot of states aren't doing that because they've got other mechanisms at county government to deal with environmental hazards and remediation, and we don't in the state. And in fact, in Gustavus, one of the issues is they had a fire truck that they had inherited from the state for their volunteer fire department and used it on response to a fire and polluted the well. So Gustavus has both kinds of exposure that sort of bring about the reality of how can PFAS get into your drinking water system and you didn't even know you were doing it.
Follow up,
Representative Rose.
And the oil and gas field, or industry, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and they've been engaged in this, and fairly early on in the process, excuse me, through the chair, the process of developing the legislation, that we've given them a carve out because they're as opposed to airports, where the FAA says we have alternative satisfactory firefighting substances, in the oil and gas industry, basically, they say there isn't a substitute at this point for that high temperature fire of oil and gas on fire. So, you know, once we had a carve out, there hasn't been a continued engagement of setting those threshold levels.
And follow up, Representative Rocha.
Thank you. We talked about liability. I'm just going through the numbers there as you went through on the sectical, sectional. But when we talked about liability in the end, is a penalty for any liabilities addressed in this bill? And then, if you want me to ask these one at a time, I can.
Mr. Clark.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, once again, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon, Representative Rauscher. The liabilities that are addressed in this bill are focused on the costs of testing the water in areas where PFAS, say, spill or exposure is, you know, determined to have taken place, providing clean drinking water to any people in communities who have their own water source contaminated by PFAS, and also the voluntary blood testing requirements in the bill. And granted, you know, Mr. Chairman and Representative Rauscher, there are going to be massive questions about liability coming in the future. It's happening, you know, all over the nation. And you could say that the Dunleavy administration's recent announcement that they are bringing suit against PFAS manufacturers plays into this anticipated future need of a great many resources to go after actual remediation of these sites. But this bill is much more narrowly focused on just these questions of clean drinking water, testing of water near areas of PFAS contamination, and the voluntary blood testing of certain people who have exposure.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Rocha.
Thank you very much. When it gets to retro in this bill, that retroactivity, liability, where, if the liability does not lie with the fire departments, according to what I understand about this bill, where is it going to lie? Is there any blanket ideology on where it's going to lie and who's going to be responsible, or is every case going to be different and you have no idea?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rauscher, that is a good question, in that it'll be certainly a challenge for the Department of Environmental Conservation to have to try to determine these liabilities. Some of it is, I hate to speculate too much, but some of it could be construed as liabilities from our own Department of Transportation, if that were to be looked into. I don't know this necessarily to be the case, but it is something to consider as a possibility. In other cases, it would be, eventually somewhere down the road, oil and gas facilities or refineries that have, you know, discharges of these chemicals, after certain dates of effectiveness or applicability. But it is, I can't answer that question thoroughly for you, but I can promise you it is going to be a challenge. As provisions of this bill would be implemented.
So. Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
No follow-up? Thank you. And I know we've got Representative McCabe and Fields, but I just wanted to ask a question, and it, I guess, dovetails from what Representative Fields was asking about as far as the EPA's recommendation, where that's found at a federal level. And if you, I know you said you'd follow up with that. If you can provide, you spoke to the threshold numbers that were found in the parts per trillion as far as ours not, I guess, meeting the recommended levels. If you can provide some documentation on that, that'd be interesting to see, because I think you mentioned that like PHXA or something didn't have a level that was, you know, listed as a threshold. And that, I mean, that'd be just some interesting stuff to read about as far as how we're putting those different levels, less straining levels into regulation. Yeah, that's all it was as far as the follow-up. Representative McKay, then Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, I have some experience in this field. I've got a master's in environmental engineering, and I did some groundwater cleanup work in my past, and of course in the oil industry. I'll just start here. I'll try to make my questions real, you know, brief and concise. And 345A states that a person who causes a fire that results, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know, if a person starts a fire just by accident, he's going to be held liable. So that's kind of an issue with 345A. I'm just wondering about that. And then on your page 2 of your sectional summary, they talk about the alternative firefighting substance. I wonder if that even exists. I'm just curious, you know, technically, do we have that next generation? Because in the oil field, we always use halon. Representative Gillum may remember halon was used for years, and then I can't remember exactly, but there was some toxic problem with halon, so then we had to stop using halon, and then we went to the foams. And so what is that next generation substance that can be used on these frankly wicked fires involving oil and gas substances?
Representative McKay, you won't give him a chance to answer the first two. I mean, just for tracking, yeah, tracking the conversation.
All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McCabe. The so far as the liability in terms of, say, if the release of, you know, if the, you know, fire led to the release of these foams, and was it an accidental question, then you know, this section of the bill does read person, but it's in the same sense that a person can be a company or, you know, commercial entity. So those liabilities, I believe, would be you know, determined according to what sort of degree of say negligence may have played a part on you know, in the incident and on the part of the company. I mean, that's the best I could do in terms of
I do want to, through the chairman, Mr. McKay, the intent, and this is the second time we've had this bill, when it says a person causes a fire, so if you're an arsonist, then you're liable. But if you call the fire department because you've got an electrical fire and your house is on fire, you're not liable, right? The crafting was to draw a distinction, because we do not want to discourage anyone who is faced with a fire from going, should I call my fire department? Should my fire department respond? But if you've caused a fire, yeah, and it, you know, in parts of Alaska, this could be a wildland fire that you started by negligence that is now spread, and the volunteer fire departments have responded with PFAS and are soaking down a huge area impacting water systems. Yeah, yeah, but not, your house is on fire, please call 911.
Yeah, right, tip over my barbecue grill and, you know.
Thank you for that clear instruction, Ms. Representative Hannon. Representative McKay, did you have follow? Or you had a bunch of questions.
It seems to me that these things are very unfortunate, but it seems like this could be a candidate for Superfund. Has anybody talked about Superfund? Because you know, it's sort of like when there's nobody to go after. Frankly, it becomes a Superfund problem, and from my experience in these matters. And the chemicals were legal, and everybody thought they'd be fine. So then these...
Representative McKay.
All right, sorry.
No. I'm actually just remembering that we didn't talk about your second question from the first round as far as the next generation fire suppressants. If you can address that and then move on to superfunds and et cetera.
Go ahead, Tim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McKay, there's not 100% consensus on whether the alternatives developed so far are as effective as the PFAS, bearing firefighting foams. However, we have heard from a bill similar to this bill was introduced in the 31st legislature, and I do recall testimony from a man whom I believe to be a former head of the fire department at SeaTac Airport in the state of Washington, saying that he's highly confident in these new foams that have been developed and are still under development as being safe and effective alternatives. But I mentioned that with the caveat that I don't believe the consensus is 100% on that question yet.
So. Thank you, Mr. Clark. Superfunding, I think, was the next one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative McKay. The only way I could answer that is to say that a lot of people in Alaska and across the country really do hope that these issues are going to be addressed, rigorously at the federal government level. And what you're describing, for all I know, could be an approach that the federal government is forced to take, given, number one, as you pointed out, it may be difficult to identify every liable participant, and just the sheer scale of the problem is going to be something to behold. So.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Just want to note that we do have invited testimony and public testimony for the next 35 minutes of our time here, but Representative McKay, if you had some follow-ups.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead.
And let me, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Hannon.
A couple when you were asking about alternatives, this is sort of the point where FAA and airports have found some alternative foam compounds that are satisfactory. Oil and gas industry has not found something that works as good to stop a oil fire at an oil refinery. And that's where that sort of carve out and distinction. Okay. And the FAA has been weeding them out and narrowing it. So they've, for the last 2 years, not find an airport that didn't do the mandatory testing. And then I think part of the EPA Superfund site, and this is me going back 2.5 years, is that the EPA Superfund, because all the substances don't have a regulated level, because some of them are new, like the one that's Gen X, that chemical compound is only like a decade or 15 years old. It's one of the newer PFAS, PFOA. Mm. So they're so fragmented, and they haven't had standards for each of them, that it doesn't qualify as a Superfund site till we have toxic studies on each of the levels, and they go, yep, it really did kill everything there. So sort of the speculation is these industrial sites will likely be deemed Superfund sites, but they don't meet the criteria. The EPA kind of lags behind. This is one of those points. By the time we're jumping in it, where we've had some major industrial litigation in Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Hampshire, and Michigan, we're getting there.
You can only know you messed up after you messed up.
Yeah.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Quick question. I realize the answer to this doesn't really affect whether we should or shouldn't pass this bill, but I am curious if there are new technologies in the pipeline that show promise for replacing PFAS chemicals in the oil and gas industry.
I have no idea. I haven't gotten to the next phase of the research in PFAS. I'm still in
No problem.
Oh, my God, just what curious, do we do thank now?
You. Thank you, Representative Hannah, Representative Fields. Any other questions, comments from committee members before we move on to invited testimony? Is that a...
You're good? I can wait.
Okay. Representative Shragi.
Likewise, I have questions, but I can wait until afterwards.
Okay. Well, with that, I'd invite Representative Hannon to invite Kelly McLaughlin, if you want to give
Kelly
her an introduction.
Kelly McLaughlin, and I urge you all to listen closely. Ms. McLaughlin is not a professional scientist, but if I hadn't told you that, you would not know that. And I believe she will speak to both her personal story, how she came engaged, and now is sort of one of the leading experts in Alaska on PFAS pollution and our ability to treat it.
Ms. McLaughlin, the floor is yours if you could please put your name on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kelly McLaughlin, and I'm here representing the Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition. And Representative Hannon, I appreciate your introductions, but they give me anxiety. I don't know if I can live up to this now. I do want to touch on a few things that were mentioned already, just quickly, and then I'll give the planned testimony that I had. So I think there's questions about liability, and there will be, I think, as long as PFAS is in the ground and in our water, there will be questions about liability. Ultimately, the liability will be resolved in the national lawsuit that the state of Alaska has joined. It ultimately goes back to 3M. So there can be fingers pointed all the way down the line, but really this is a stopgap until we get to that point where there's national help and broad responsibility for this problem is dealt with. As far as the alternate foams, there are fluorine-free foams in use around the world. They are in use in the oil and gas industry with good success. There's a group called IPEN that's put out a comprehensive report on that, and either Alaska Community Action on Toxics or GPAC could get you all that report to review. So I think that while this bill doesn't address the oil and gas industry switching over, I think that is in our near future. That there are foams that we can use that will be non-toxic, I hope, moving forward. And then the amount for the drinking water standards, I think this bill uses Michigan's report, which is good and defensible. However, there are several other states that have gone with a different approach, and they're calling it a class-based approach. So they're basically regulating the fluorine-carbon bond because this class of chemicals is enormous, and you can pretty much forever come up with new chemicals that have a fluorine-carbon bond. So, and have, you know, four different letters starting with P and S until you run out of letters. I think there's like 8,000, 10,000 of these chemicals. So regulating that bond is the ideal. This bill is a step in the right direction. PFOS is our main concern, at least in Gustavus. And so that will trigger before any of the other ones would trigger. That'll trigger for clean drinking water for people. So I'll go into my prepared testimony now, and I really appreciate you all being here and hearing this testimony today and hearing the bill today, and the questions that I heard asked have been fantastic so far, so thank you for being so thoughtful. I really would love to have a couple of hours of your time. I'd love to have you all over to Gustavus. We can get coffee, and then we can walk around the plume, so we can do that next time. I first became aware of PFAS in August 2018 when I received a letter from the DOT that stated the school's water and several airport drinking water wells were contaminated. I immediately started researching the substance and learned that it was an enormous group of toxic chemicals, and I quickly found two things to be true. The first one was that these chemicals are everywhere and they're highly toxic. The second one is that there's not nearly enough information on or protection from PFAS. This bill is a step in the right direction for protecting the health of Alaskans and the wild places where we make our homes and hunt and harvest. It is imperative that AFFF no longer be used at airports across the state. Even a small amount of this stuff can catastrophically contaminate soil, surface, and groundwater immediately adjacent and for miles around. It doesn't break down, and remediation is difficult. It will save the state money to be proactive today. In order to ensure Alaskans are drinking safe water, drinking water levels must be lower than the current EPA guidelines. Many states are regulating PFAS as a class with a cap at around 20 parts per trillion total. So that's what I was talking about before. It would be any detectable fluorine carbon bond with a cap at 20 parts per trillion. So that if somebody's drinking water, if a person is a mile away, they're going to have different PFAS constituents in their drinking water because the shorter chains travel farther. So it's important that you're not just regulating a handful of them, but all of them. The Gustavus PFAS Action Coalition has led and collaborated on testing Gustavus local blood serum levels. We've tested plants grown locally, livestock raised locally, wild foods, and fish and game. We've worked with the Department of Fish and Game. We've worked with the ACAT and University of Indiana and anybody who will work with us with on testing everything that we could possibly test. We've taken water samples in addition to what the state has done, and we worked with Indiana University and ACAT to correlate PFAS levels in water samples with PFAS levels in blood samples. There is a direct correlation. The PFAS chemicals you're seeing in the water are the same ones that are showing up in our blood at basically the same levels. There's a marked effect on every plant, every animal, and every local resident where AFFF is used. One of the reasons that I chose to live in Gustavus is the ability to be self-sufficient. So I have chickens, I'm getting goats, got dogs, and I just adopted a puppy. For every animal that I now choose to bring onto my property and raise on my property, I have to consider the ethical question of knowingly contributing to their potential ill health. That's not something that I want. So I ask you all to please consider that question. You have the power in this bill to begin to remedy the mass poisoning of Alaskans across the state. And I'm very happy to answer any questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. We'll open it up for some back and forth discussion with Ms. McLaughlin and the committee, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I was wondering, I read, this was a pattern after Michigan. Somewhere, and I'm looking in section 4303-345, section A, similar to what Representative McKay asked, but a person who causes a fire that results in the release of firefighting substance containing this substance is liable for the cost. And then in B, a person who extinguishes the fire by releasing the firefighting substance contains is not liable for the cost. And so what I'm trying to understand is what's this drastic fire that has to release this substance, and what are they? I mean, obviously trash fire out in your yard and you got a little brush fire going on, or even a forest fire, I'm not sure that they're going to release this chemical. So I guess what I'm wanting to know is what's a person going to do to make this fire department come by and release this chemical?
And maybe that's not a question for Ms. McLaughlin, but Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will interject and give the example. So Gustavus actually, through the chair, has two pollution plumes of PFAS. One from the airport runway DOT mandatory FAA annual testing. The foam worked, you sprayed it off, it runs into the ditch, and it went into the well. The second plume, not too far away, was a wildland fire in someone's acreage. They called the fire department, which is in Gustavus's volunteer, where they have a fire truck that they inherited from the state, and they've sprayed PFAS foam, not knowing that that's what the fire retardant was in the truck. the homeowner under our bill would not be liable. They didn't, unless they were found liable of causing the fire. And I don't actually remember how that fire started, but for most of Gustavus, the PFAS pollution cleanup tab is DOT's. DOT from the runoff from the airport has been responsible for providing safe drinking water for, we're going on 3 years now. The other plume, where it was the fire trucks dispersed it in response to a fire, the question of who is responsible for the costs of that cleanup. The state has actually been in negotiations and potential litigation with the Community Volunteer Fire Department in Gustavus because they said you polluted the water. DEC and DOT have been paying for clean water by they actually bring bottled water to Gustavus and have for almost 3 years or 2.5 years. And they're asking that the city fire truck and that cost be paid back to them. This bill would say if you cause a fire, then you're responsible for it. That is different, though, than, as I said to Mr. McKay, there's a fire at your house and you call the fire department. You didn't necessarily cause that fire. So we don't want the liability to stop someone from doing it, but there are fires where people go out and intentionally set them. And if PFAS is used in response to that, we want the arsonist to be responsible for the cost of the cleanup.
Thank you, Representative Hennen. Follow Representative Rocher.
I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate answering that. But I'm wondering, what fire did I start that PFAS had to come and kill? Does that make any sense?
I guess my, just, and I'm going to have Mr. Clark want to clarify, but it's that.
Are you talking like chemical fires, wood fires? I think that's the frame of questioning that I'm hearing anyway.
Part of it is that fire departments all across the state, not the professional ones primarily our volunteer fire departments, have inherited equipment from the state that has PFAS in them. And they may not know that. So it's not that they needed to use PFAS, but that was the fire retardant in the fire response truck that they had. Gustavus has no centralized water system, so they don't have hydrants you hook up to.
So, Representative, is it fair to say that PFAS, PFOA foam is predominantly used in chemical fires, fuel fires, not necessarily called, it's not the first call that you make, I need a PFAS vehicle when I have a brush fire.
You probably don't know what's in your fire truck unless you're hooking up to hydrants.
Yeah. Is it germane to this discussion?
Yes.
Representative Shragi.
Thank you. Through the chair, it sounds like PFAS chemicals are being used incidentally and not in a response to any specific type of fire. So it's an accidental use of PFAS just because it's in the vehicle, but it does sound like it would only be chemical fires or other industrial fires that would require PFAS chemicals, and it's not likely that any individual person would end up causing a fire that requires PFAS use. That's my read on it.
I think that's where Representative Rush's questioning was coming from. Why do we have PFAS fire retardant anyway? And I think it's more so for chemical and aviation fuel type fires. Representative Rocher, if you've got a follow-up or if Mr. Clark wants to interject.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Tim Clark, staff to Representative Hannon. If I could just clarify a couple of points that I think, you know, have been touched on but maybe need a little more emphasis. Usually, you know, when number one, the liabilities discussed in this section of the bill really come down to, as I've mentioned before, the supplying fresh drinking water to people whose wells have been contaminated, testing drinking water in areas where, or testing wells and water tables in areas where PFAS contamination is near, and also the voluntary blood testing. But also when it comes to a person being, you know, discussed in these sections, I would emphasize again that is primarily focused on industrial entities, companies, that are in the business where if a kind of fire on their premises, you know, came up, that a PFAS chemical, well, would be regarded as necessary in order to deal with that fire. And that's also why you'll see that there is a, you know, it's noted that, say, a fire that is residential or take place is involving a passenger car vehicle are, like, exempt from these sections. Because obviously those types of fires would not be, you know, something arising from an industrial incident or what have you, and these liability sections are not aimed at individual Alaskans. They're aimed at industrial entities and companies and stuff. So.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Representative Rocher.
I guess I'll try one follow-up.
One follow-up, Mr. Representative Rocher.
Then I'll relent. So are we getting rid of the reason for PFAS being in any fire truck other than on a military base or in the oil field or at an airport? Is that what we're doing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rocher, I believe in instances where, say, a community's firefighting equipment was found subsequent to fighting a fire to have included these PFAS chemicals was simply an unfortunate accident that is not necessary or not by any means a commonplace. It's just so happened that in the case of this fire truck that was given over to use to the community of Gustavus, still had these chemicals on board, and I don't know every detail of that incident, but it's my understanding that they were actually unaware that that's what it was loaded with. Had they known that, they could have, I suppose, made an effort to get rid of the PFAS cargo and clean the truck and have it ready for conventional firefighting.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
All the answers.
Thank you, Representative Rocher. And I'll just remind the committee that we're going to go into public testimony here in about 5 minutes. We've got about five people on the line. So with that, Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, just a quick clarification question, I guess two of them actually. The definition of a person that we're using in here is not a person as in me, but it's a person as in the definition in statute that allows for an incorporation, that includes a corporation and includes business and includes a lot of different things as opposed to just me as a person, as an individual. Is that correct?
Chairman Buck, Representative Hopkins, yes, that's correct.
All right, thank you. And then my other clarifying question is, as we're worrying about where the liability of this using the PFAS foam, unless it's unknown that there's PFAS in your fire truck, as we were discussing, really that's out of, it's only between now and October that would be a known use, because at that point it's going to be banned at airports as well, based on the EPA work.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hopkins, yes.
So it's only just a few months from now until that's more or less off the table. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hopkins. We've got Representative Gillum, then Representative Shragi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The PFAS, is that only in industrial fire retardant, or is it something we'd have in our home?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gillum, I'm unaware of any residents that would keep a PFAS, fire extinguisher in their home on any regular basis. I believe that is overwhelmingly for industrial uses only.
In regards to fire retardants only, you probably have it on your frying pan, though. So you don't have it in your kitchen sink, under the kitchen sink fire extinguisher. But
that's correct, Mr. Chairman. And I would add that there were times, in recent history where PFAS was used on water repellent clothing. Scotch Guard contains PFAS, in addition to what's already been mentioned, Teflon pan type applications, that kind of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Follow up, okay, Representative Gillum.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you. And just to clarify, so my understanding is these chemicals are just used for basically liquid fuel fires that are really, really hot. And then they're also used in, like you said, Teflon and fire-resistant fabrics and stuff. But the big issue is the water systems, which is firefighting foam for those high-temperature liquids, but they're just not for common use. Is that your understanding as well?
That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you. And then just to clarify on Representative Hopkins' line of questioning, so they are not banning the chemicals in October. The FAA is just stopping the requirement that they be used for testing or for training purposes. Is that right? And that, but this bill would ban the use of the chemicals. I'm just trying to get my facts straight. There's been a lot of discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi, the bill, in fact, after October 2021, will ban the use of PFAS-containing firefighting foams in all applications in the state except for within the oil and gas industry, because it is presumed that the decision on the part of FAA no longer to require them is tantamount to the acknowledgement of existing effective and safe alternative firefighting foams.
Thank you. And then a more substantive question in the last minute or so that we have here before public testimony. So I'm looking at 345. This is on page 3, so section 345, item B. And at the end there, just to read through this, a person who extinguishes a fire by releasing firefighting substances containing the chemical is not liable for the costs associated with all of this. Unless the firefighting substance was released for training or testing purposes. And I understand that the fire departments are no longer using PFAS chemicals in training or in testing, but is there any concern that this would create some liability retroactively, where I know that fire departments have in the past used these chemicals for training and testing? And is there any concern there, and do we need to add a explicit exemption that states that there's no retroactive liability as a result of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shragi, I would hesitate to answer that without looking into it a little more carefully. The substance to that is, this is meant to be a carve out for a fire department, where when they're responding to an actual fire somewhere, you don't want to be holding firefighters liable for doing their best to save life and property. And the reason for the testing or drilling being mentioned there is because you do not want these chemicals to be used when they are not absolutely necessary. I mean, and it is perfectly possible to drill and to train by using other non-PFAS containing foams. But
thank you, Mr. Clark.
In terms of that question of how you could liabilities may or may not be entangled in a way that's unintended, I would ask the opportunity to look into that a little further before answering.
Thank you, Mr. Clark.
Follow-up comment that I'd like to work with you guys to make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences where we create a liability for past training that occurred.
Thank you, Representative Shragi. And we'll be picking this bill back up on Wednesday, but we have noticed public hearing, so I'd like to pivot into that now. I believe we have a handful of folks online. With that, public hearing for House Bill 171 is now open. If you can please put your name on the record, your affiliation, residency, and provide your two-minute public testimony in regards for House Bill 171. Hopefully you'll hear the alarm go off like this. I don't know if you can hear that, probably not, but if you do hear it, please work on wrapping up your public testimony. With that, Marissa, I think we can go to Pamela Miller. Pamela, the floor is yours for public testimony on 171.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee, and I thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today in support of HB 171. My name is Pamela Miller, and I am a senior scientist and executive director of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and I was recently appointed to the National Academy of Sciences to develop guidance on PFAS testing and health outcomes. The health and safety of our water is obviously of utmost importance to all Alaskans. In Alaska, the destructive use of PFAS industrial firefighting foams on fuel-related fires on military bases and airports has contaminated the drinking water of communities from the North Slope to Southeast Alaska. PFAS have been found at over 100 individual sites in nearly 30 locations across Alaska, and at least 10 Alaska communities have PFAS in their drinking water at levels deemed unsafe by the US EPA. And it is likely that this is really the tip of the iceberg. We know that PFAS is contaminating groundwater and surface water, fish, wild game, garden produce, and backyard chickens in Alaska. Several lakes in Alaska are now closed to fishing as a result of PFAS contamination, and yet there is no cohesive plan for testing of water, produce, or fish and wildlife in areas affected by PFAS. The public water supply in Fairbanks and hundreds of private wells in the Fairbanks North Star borough are contaminated with PFAS. In 2019, Golden Heart Utilities in Fairbanks suspended all sales of its compost that had been sold annually for many years to local farmers and gardeners due to PFAS contamination in compost. And recently, residents near Sand Lake in Anchorage are calling for testing of residential wells in lakes in the vicinity of the former Coolis Air National Guard base, where high levels of PFAS have been found. We've heard today, and I'll wrap it up, thank you, just to say that there are serious health effects of these chemicals at very low exposure levels. There are safe alternatives, and I helped to put together an expert panel on alternatives to PFAS, and I provided the report to the committee. And also just to say that many other states are taking action on these chemicals as a class at lower levels than the Michigan standards, so we would like to see the bill strengthened but very strongly supported. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Miller, for providing your public testimony. Up next, we've got Mr. Kenish. I believe you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation and residency. You may begin your public testimony.
Hello, I'm a retired chemistry professor from UAA. I taught chemistry for 36 years, including courses in toxicology. And I'm very familiar with the issues as regards to the chemistry of these compounds. I think they've been expressed pretty clearly by the committee members and Ms. McLaughlin from Gustavus. And it's real clear that this is going to be a major problem for the future. One of the things that should be aware of is that the toxicity of these compounds has only been relatively recently recognized. It's a horrific problem. It goes along with some of the issues of other compounds of similar nature, like, for example, the DDT, where now we find out that those compounds are being associated with cancers in marine mammals, for example. So all of these issues are related. They're all genetically driven for the most part, because the exposure ultimately trips a bunch of genetic systems and also systems that are related to our ability to protect ourselves from the chemical exposures that we might have during our lifetime. So the problem is going, it's pretty horrific in a way, and it's going to be very difficult to deal with long term. I think the important thing to think about is, how are you going to protect the people of the state of Alaska? Also, how are you going to protect all of the various organisms that people are dependent upon, especially people who are living in a subsistence lifestyle, for example? How are they going to be protected from these compounds that are present in the fish and game that they're harvesting? So I think you need to go a little broader in terms of what you're trying to do. This is a good start, but I think you're going to have to look at other areas that have to be considered and dealt with in a meaningful way with regards to litigation, not litigation, but laws that are appropriate for the problem. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenish, for your concise public testimony. Moving on, we've got Ms. Christine Benson. If you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation and your residency, and begin your public testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is Christine Benson. I'm a resident of Juneau, and I'm representing myself. And I want to urge the committee to pass out of the committee HB 171. With a dozen communities in Alaska with known contaminated water, it's imperative that the legislature step in to set a drinking water standard based on health. The federal EPA advisory level for drinking water is not protective of health, and the EPA is moving too slow to update their standard. PFAS have been used for firefighting training. That's where the contamination is mostly coming from. And it's very good that this bill acknowledges that communities will have the foam in storage at the time of the ban, and the bill arranges for safe disposal. Banning the fluorinated firefighting foams will be protective of the firefighters themselves and prevent the creation of even more contaminated sites. As further groundwater testing is done in Alaska, we're likely to find even more affected communities that have become contaminated because of firefighting training. This bill is an excellent start to address both the existing PFAS contaminated sites and prevent further sites. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Up next, we've got Mr. Steve Risotto. If you can please put your name on the record, your affiliation and residency, and begin with your public testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Pat Gatak and members of the committee. My name is Steve Risotto, and I am testifying on behalf of the American Chemistry Council based in Washington, D.C. ACC appreciates the opportunity to provide comments on House Bill 171. We provided written comments to the committee earlier today, along with ACC's Alliance for Telomere Chemistry Stewardship, that I will summarize for you now. ACC opposes the bill as currently written based on several concerns. First, the bill would create standards for several PFAS without going through the normal regulatory process. Before moving ahead with state limits, we urge the committee to consider what is already being done at the federal level and what information may already exist about PFAS levels in the state. Our second concern is that the proposal would create responsibility for PFAS releases that could extend well beyond those that were likely contemplated. Such parties may include local fire departments who tested and trained with their foam systems, communities that operated landfills that released PFAS, wastewater treatment plants that distributed biosolids containing PFAS, and farmers who applied those biocides to their lands. Among the responsibilities assigned by the bill would be for blood testing, for which there is not an appropriate basis for assessing the results. In addition, ACC is concerned that the proposal would place restrictions on the use of firefighting foams containing PFAS before effective fluorine-free alternatives are readily available. While these concerns lead us to oppose HB 171, we stand ready to work with the committee and the department to develop ways to effectively address PFAS issues. We strongly agree that all Alaskans should have access to clean drinking water, but believe that determining what is clean should be based on evaluating all the available information through the regulatory process. ACC has supported legislation to restrict testing and training with foam containing PFAS, the most significant source of release from foam operations. We also support guidance on appropriate conditions for the complete destruction of PFAS-containing materials. Thank you for your attention. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Risotto. We're going to wrap up with public testimony, then we'll open it for questions afterwards. Last person I believe on the line is Sarah Thomas. If you could please put your name on the record, your affiliation and residency. You may begin your public testimony.
Good afternoon. This is Sarah Thomas. I'm a community member. I reside currently in Anchorage. Until recently, I lived in Iqaluit. And I'm a social scientist. I began studying PFAS in 2017 after they came to the community of Iqaluit and told us about the contamination of Imasuk Lake, which was used as drinking water up until the 2000s. I fully support HB 171. We know the links to cancer and thyroid issues. We also know our community has way too many cancer and thyroid issues. As well as many other health issues. And I'm here because I'm tired of losing young people to cancer. We know that this has been called the biggest cover-up since the big tobacco. And the question of liability is heavy on my mind. We also know that 3M, the manufacturer of this chemical, chose to suppress the information that this chemical was toxic and has been making billions of dollars for generations now since the 50s when the chemical was first developed. So I urge the legislation to continue to push for liability, corporate social liability, legislative liability. The more that our government is allowing these chemicals to be used, it was kind of ironic that fracking was brought up just prior to this, so I sat through and listened about these, pushing more artificial chemicals deep into the earth at a hot springs location. It's concerning. And as a mother, as a person who has drank contaminated water, who has so many cases of cancer around us, I urge you to continue pushing on this and looking at accountability. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah, for your concise comments on House Bill 171. With that, Marissa, can you clarify there's nobody else online? Thank you. With that, we'll close public testimony. If there's anyone that would like to make a clarifying statement in regards to what we heard during public testimony, you're more than welcome to before we close out today's meeting. Seeing or hearing none, as mentioned, we'll pick this bill back up on Wednesday and hopefully by then have our committee substitutes for HB 98, which I'm sure you all are familiar with. I want to thank everybody online that was there to help answer some of the questions and answers as we went along, and those who provided public testimony and invited testimony in regards to House Bill 171. And also to, I don't know if they're still on, but the folks that helped us get through House Bill 135. With that, we'll call this meeting adjourned at 3:05 p.m.